we cut the service and had soup and then fled the hill like it was about to explode, which made for a very exciting week in the days to follow with raccoon incursions and everything else. It has been a wonderful week, but what it does mean is I didn't have to work too much on a new sermon. But I did change the name of the sermon, just so it sounds good. This is Liberating Love Part 3, or 2-ish. Throwing Stones, a Redux. But I thought it was funny as I listened to this very upbeat song about snow whirling and twirling, thinking, maybe not this week. One of the theological statements I often come back to when I reflect on the liberal religion comes from the Unitarian theologian James Luther Adams, and he defined 5 important things in the liberal faith that he called the 5 smooth stones. And just as a reminder, it does not mean that we have stone soup today. There is not going to be any today. That was last week, but I'm sorry. So just in case, it sounds like in the sermon I'm saying we do. We don't. But the 5 smooth stones that James Luther Adams talked about were this. He says, stone 1 is religious liberalism depends on the principle that revelation is not sealed. Stone 2 is that all relations between persons ought ideally through mutual free consent or be through free consent, not coercion. The third one is liberal religion affirms the moral obligation to direct one's effort towards the establishment of a just and loving community. Number 4 is, it's my favorite, and a lot of it's because of the language. We deny the immaculate conception of virtue and affirm the necessity of the social interaction. We're not talking about that one today. And the last one is liberalism holds that resources, both divine and human, that are available for the achievement of meaningful change justify an attitude of ultimate optimism, which many of us later have called hope. And though it may sound as if I'm throwing stones during this sermon, I might just be dropping them in the pot for soup last week. You can laugh at that. I'm going to make that joke a lot. You're going to be tired of it. Today's sermon focuses on stone number 2. All relations between persons ought ideally to be through mutual free consent, not coercion. The idea is that we relate to one another as Unitarian Universalists, members of Hope, friends, and human beings by mutual agreement, not coercion. Or manipulation, whether literal or implied. We don't leverage eternal salvation or damnation for anyone who wants to be a member. 1, this gets in the way of our universalism. 2, the dependence on eternal torment as punishment for a moral action is coercive. Instead of do as we say or else, we choose goodness for no other reason than it is good to do so. But see, coercion works on many levels. In the book Cold Anger, Mary Moreno tells her story of a childhood growing up the daughter of a migrant worker. She and her family lived in abject poverty throughout her childhood. And in the interview with Mary Beth Rogers, she reflects one day on that childhood, saying, everyone was poor, but we were the poorest of the poor. One time my father came home and he was happy because he was able to get a dollar, because a dollar was a lot of money. The way he got the dollar was that some patron gave it to him for his vote. I didn't know things like that at the time. I was only a little girl and we were just glad that he could buy bread. But it stayed with me, you know, who pays for a vote? Every time there was an election, it was tamales and beer, votes for the Mexicans. It always bothered me, and I didn't exactly know why. In 1971, Mary Morano was 23 years old and working as a patient representative at a San Antonio charity hospital. She had many duties, but many of them centered around the Spanish-speaking patients, helping them fill out papers. She would also help people who'd been assaulted work with the police and manage the paperwork for the bodies that came in through the morgue. She would fill out a lot of the papers, contact relatives, and work to get the body released for them. One day she grabbed her clipboard as a new body came into the morgue. She pulled back the cover like she'd done 1,000 times and saw her father's face staring up at her. A few hours before, her father had been in a holding cell in the local jail. She didn't know this or she would have gotten him out. Moreno's father had been picked up 3 blocks from his home, disoriented. The officers assumed he was drunk and left him in a holding cell. By the time he arrived at the jail, he was barely conscious. The cause of death was a flare-up from sclerosis of the liver. That's why he was disoriented. His blood was toxic. He'd been in jail for 5 hours before he died. The medical examiner said that all he needed was dialysis and a blood transfusion, and he would have lived. Instead, because he was dressed poorly and appeared drunk, they didn't follow the appropriate protocols, and he died. When Mary began to fight for accountability, a police lieutenant she'd worked with regularly said, "Well, Mary, if we take every disoriented bum we picked up to the hospital, we'd have to build at least 3 more charity hospitals just to hold them." She found herself unprepared as she fought for accountability. Over time, she realized that her voice was not important enough to the people that she needed to hear it. From that moment forward, Mary started working with an organizing collective that taught her how to make her voice be heard. Through the 70s and 80s, Mary would organize with churches to help communities in poverty to take back their voice through voting and education around political action. Often people would ask why she did all this through the church. And she said, "What is the church if it's not helping people? I see it as a hypocrisy. If you go pray for an hour on Sunday, then come home and watch television and say, 'To hell with my neighbor.'" Often church works, church work in association to poverty comes through donations of blankets, food, school supplies, or donations to shelters, which is important work. But it can be easily forgotten that there is other important work. We can work to make those services unnecessary through not just the feeding of the poor, but the empowerment of them. We do that through helping them take their power back so that those politicians who'd rather buy votes, which are so divorced from their communities, have to listen. This means that they have to learn to navigate systems that are often responsible themselves for the oppression that they are in. After generations of being treated like they're powerless, people will often become unaware that they actually have inherent power in this system, even as it stands now. The problem is that when you've been treated like you're worthless for years, and it's been passed down through generations, one can begin to believe that they have no power, that they are not part of what Martin Luther King Jr. called an inescapable web of mutuality, and they begin to see their dreams break against the wall of coercive power. See, coercive power, we're talking about mutuality and coercion. Coercive power utilizes threat and fear of punishment to keep people in check, to keep people marginalized, to keep the direction of wealth in one space. One example of this during the civil rights movement was when many African Americans registered to vote. Registration was very public. You had to go, especially in Mississippi, you had to go to the office and you had to take a test, and you sat and they made you sit there for a while. And it was easy, because it was public, to threaten their job or to threaten them with veiled physical abuse. Someone might come in and say, well, your employer, Miss Whatever, won't like it when I tell her that I saw you here today. And she would have to decide whether voting was more important than the job that she had. It was coercive power that silenced survivors of the Tulsa Race Massacre for so many years that they didn't begin to speak up about it until just a bit ago. So much so that a lot of that history has just recently, in the last 20 years, come to light. But the use of coercive power is still alive and well today. In Oklahoma, political retribution against public officials has become commonplace, especially now as our Board of Education is making national news. And with a state board that is unwilling to take responsibility for decades of underfunding. It is coercive power that forces LGBTQ youth deeper into the closet so that they can live more safely without abuse. And it is coercive power that causes some women to hide their pregnancy through fear that they may not be able to get the medical care that they need at the most important time of their life. See, coercion is always present when class systems come into play, when large communities can get away with murder because they can afford an army, or large companies can get away with murder because they can afford an army of lawyers. And coercion is always at play when we add more and more requirements just to practice your right to vote. James Luther Adams reminds us that all relationship between persons should be rooted in mutual consent and not coercion. However, coercion is often the hand that is dealt. Moreno asks, what is the church if it's not for helping people? Adams reminds us, faith is the sister of justice. And as Unitarian Universalists, we affirm that all human beings should be treated with dignity. To truly treat someone with dignity, we don't just meet the immediate need, we help them find the power within themselves that authoritarianism tries to take away. Therefore, we don't do things for people, we work together with people. Ernesto Cortez uses a specific definition when he talks about this power. He says, power is nothing more than the ability to act on your own behalf, to act on your own interest. Cortez goes on to say, we are trained to give consent to people in authority. First, it's to our parents, then our teachers, then our bosses and politicians, he explains. But when you become mature, when you are informed, when you know yourself, you begin to take responsibility for your own actions, and you begin to make decisions about when you will and will not consent to someone else's power. And remember that all relations between persons ought highly to be through mutual free consent, not coercion. It is our tradition and hope to celebrate the story of Stone Soup. Three soldiers returning from war, hungry and tired, but when they met with resistance from the community saying, we don't have enough, the soldiers, hungry and cold, said, we have plenty, we will make soup for you. No doubt the soldiers in the story came into a small hamlet where people themselves felt stepped on by the powers to be. No doubt the people there lived in fear that they did not have enough to help themselves. No doubt that the people there felt bad for the soldiers, but questioned their own power to make a difference. And no doubt they did not believe that they had the ability to act on their behalf or that of their own interest. The villagers weren't bad people. They lived in fear of scarcity. But then there was this magic of the stone soup, or the magic of the soup stone. And no doubt the villagers knew that the magic of the soup stone was not that it made soup, but that it made community. Coercive power flows from the top and cements itself through the isolation of the poor and marginalized peoples. So sure, it is important to help the poor, to provide for their needs with food and with clothes, but more so to remind them that, like we remind ourselves, that when we come together, we have power and can hold our leaders accountable. And together, we can retake that power and make good soup. Ernesto Cortez says in the book Cold Anger, there are only two ways to build power like this. It takes organized money or organized people. We're obviously not going to have a huge concentration of money, so when we're talking about power as a social concept, we're talking about two or more people coming together with a plan and acting on it. Sometimes it's hard to find a place to take action. It can be hard to find a place where we can come together and hold people who make policy decisions accountable. Luckily, though, we don't have to look far for these places or the people who know when they're happening. We are a progressive congregation that works to feed the hungry, build community, and support each other through our most difficult times. We are not the only congregation in Tulsa like that. I have the pleasure of meeting regularly with other ministers in congregations in Tulsa that, like us, want to see progressive values and love find the light of day. And we're not talking about politicians. We're talking about policy. We're talking about creating the opportunity for every child in Tulsa and the surrounding area to receive good education. Tulsa schools struggle with high absentee rate. This absenteeism causes multiple issues. One, it means that children are not able to receive a good education, but it also means that schools receive less funding because funding is based on attendance. Due to the lack of funding, we struggle getting children to school. We have issues financially just to run enough buses so that they can get there. And this is an exponential issue. The more children who cannot come to school, the less money we end up having to pay for education. With funding cuts, teachers lose support. At the beginning of the school year, teachers across the country will raise money for classroom supplies. Every year at churches, people will donate bags, pencils, uniforms, so that children are actually just able to have the minimum requirements to go to class every day. Schools are becoming more and more unsafe. Our schools are reminiscent of the nuclear age. But instead of duck and cover, we have live shooter drills. Sometimes it seems like the people who are elected are trying to sabotage public education. Public money is moving more and more towards religious schools, and the most popular of the religious schools are the ones that marginalize the LGBTQ community and many of the people who would find most of the a home here at Hope. Schools are becoming privatized, and as they become more and more, the gap between the educated and the uneducated will rise. If we continue to go down this road, many parents will no longer be able to afford to send their kids to school because school will be too expensive, which means education will become only for the elite. But see, this is not new. This process has been taking place since integration in the 1960s systematically. But that's a different sermon. Many schools are equally as segregated now as they were in 1965. There is a white-black nature to this segregation, but also a rich-poor, stable, unstable, or rich and in poverty segregation that takes place. If we continue down this path, public schools will collapse and the divide will grow. If we're truly committed to mutuality, it means that every child has access to the same education. That is what mutuality means. In the mutuality through consent that James Luther Adams calls to us turns more and more as we stay silent into coercion. Cortez says our society is based on the informed consent of all people. We play by the rules when we have the chance to participate in making them. But when we've been left out of the rulemaking and when authority is used arbitrarily against us to shut us out or deprive us of what we need to live, we can withdraw our consent. So how do we do this? How do we hold power structures accountable? Mark your calendars for Saturday, January 22nd at 2 p.m. Action is hosting an accountability session with all the candidates running in three Tulsa districts. Some of you might say, but I don't live in those districts. And I understand, neither do I. But that's where the first battle is taking place. One of the best ways that we can help empower people in poverty is to show up and let them know that they are not alone. We don't show up because it's our district. We show up because when we come together, we are able to en masse hold our leaders accountable. James Luther Adams said, our responsibility is to maintain the heritage that is ours. And he's talking about Unitarian Universalism, the heritage of response to the community forming power, power which calls us to the affirmation of the abundant love, which is not ultimately in possession, but is a holy gift. It is the ground and the goal of our vocation. See, the nature of love that we call liberating is rooted in our understanding of power dynamics that work through both active and passive means. We can choose to take power from the hands of the poor, to silence them, to marginalize them, to step on them, or we can work to give it back to them, which often means that we give up some of the power ourselves. When systems of oppression take away voices of the marginalized, they take away power. Today, that power is bought and sold as it was in the days of Mary Morano's father. We have to choose what we will do with our power. And we have to choose how we will make good soup. We have the opportunities in front of us, and Hope Unitarian Church is committed to many of those opportunities right now through action, but through many other processes. At Hope Unitarian Church, we can find a way not just to find power that has been lost to us because of our identities, but to help people who have been generationally, have had their power taken away generationally, find it again. We empower, and when we empower, we create a mutuality. That mutuality that Martin Luther King called a network of mutuality. So I invite you today at Hope Unitarian Church to help empower those in our community, to teach them that their voice is equally important as everybody else's. Thank you for listening.